This is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show.
Before we begin today's show, I want to take a quick moment and thank our sponsor, Hired.com. You folks are amazing Android developers, and the honest truth is, everyone wants to recruit you. But searching for a new job can be pretty stressful. It's scary, and it takes a whole bunch of time, and it's an important step. It's the next chapter of your life. So what can we do about it? Well, you don't have to do anything, because Hired already thought about this problem, and they have a great solution. After completing one simple application, the top employers in your area apply to hire you. So over a four-week time frame, you receive personal interview requests and upfront salary information. So you can make an informed decision about this big decision in your life. And the best part, it's always free for you to find jobs on Hired. So it's your career, it's your life. You should have better control. Usually, Hired.com's customers get a $1,000 hiring bonus, which is great. But as a listener of Fragmented, by signing up with this show's special link, which is hired.com/fragmented, you get double the bonus. So that's $2,000. If you're looking for a job, use Hired and do use our special link, and they'll know you came from us, and that'll help support the show. Thanks again to Hired for sponsoring today's show.
Now, before we get going today, we do have a cool little announcement. There is a new podcast here on the Spec.fm network. And for those of you that are not familiar, we are part of a network of podcasts, and that you can learn more at Spec.fm. And the new podcast that's coming out is called the Orthogonal Podcast. And it talks about freelancing and anything that's regarding freelancing in general. So it could be, you know, finances. How are you going to handle finances, freelancing? Maybe you're going to find new clients. And so this is just from my understanding of talking to one of the hosts on our internal Slack, actually.
There's also another announcement that I'd like to make, and I'd like to thank Benjamin for this. So Benjamin helps organize the local GDG group in Belgium, Namur. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but so he organizes the GDG there, and he mentioned that not many people know about GDG. So folks, if you want to learn more about Android and about all the things Google related, then you should find your local GDG chapter and attend those sessions, because it's an excellent opportunity to learn more and you'll benefit greatly from it.
Definitely, definitely. I cannot agree more. I helped run the GDG in Phoenix. Great bunch of folks, and a bunch of our guests are actually run GDGs as well, such as Michael Bailey in Phoenix. He runs the Phoenix one now. I believe Corey Ladislaw helps run the Philadelphia one.
Yeah, and also Zara, who organizes GDG Sydney.
All different kinds of folks out there run these things. So great bunch of folks, super talented individuals out there. Definitely check out the GDG in your local area.
Yeah. All righty. So Don,
yes.
In our 28th episode, we did a tips and tricks episode, and that got some great feedback. Like, many listeners love the show. Like, they liked that we sort of like had a power-packed episode with a whole bunch of tips. And we figured it's been some time now. It's been exactly 20 episodes since we've done that. So we thought, let's maybe start and do another round of tips and tricks.
Yeah, that would be great. And I was really surprised on the feedback on it, because we were not really too sure if folks are going to be interested in the tips or tricks episode. There was some requests for it, but it actually became quite popular. So let's give it a go for round two here.
All right, let's do it. Why don't you kick us off?
Okay, so the format here that we're going to go with is very similar to what we did last time. I'm going to give a tip, and then Kaushik's going to give a tip. And we're going to kind of go back and forth for a little while, and then we'll wrap it up at the end of the show. So we got quite a few tips here, so let's hop right into it. So my first tip that I have here is actually to try to use Kotlin. And the reason why I say that is because Kotlin is a very enjoyable language to work with. Basically, in my opinion, it recreates that developer happiness. This is the same type of thing that the guys over at 37 Signals, DHH, have said about with Rails and Ruby and so forth, is that these languages and frameworks were developed with happiness in mind. Now, I felt that exact same feeling when I started developing in Kotlin and playing with it and just implementing features here and there. It was just very enjoyable to work with. And it changed my attitude during the workday. So the language is great, but it also changed my attitude. So that's a humongous thing to look forward to. I just wish that Google would come out already and support Kotlin right out of the gate.
Perfect. So my tip is in Android Studio, we have this logcat that I imagine almost everyone universally uses. One problem that I've found usually with it is assuming you have like a crash, like your app crashes when you're developing or something happens, I've always found that it restarts. When it restarts, the logcat clears. Mm-hmm. And so traditionally people say, oh yeah, the way you do that is you go into the settings and make sure you have that checkbox that says basically don't restart and do stuff. But I found that even that doesn't work. And the reason is because by default, each of these logcat windows are linked to the process. So when your app crashes, what happens is that process is killed and a new one starts. So it automatically clears that logcat. So some time back, I tried to figure this problem out, and there's like a nice Stack Overflow answer that explains this, and I will add that to the show notes. But basically, the workaround is if you open up Android Studio on the side, you can actually add filters to your application. And so you set up a custom package filter and you can add in all the interesting stuff. And that basically survives even like processes. So you have something that's like almost the same as you would expect throughout each application. So I'll add a link to that in the show notes. But it's a pretty useful tip that I found because once I've switched to this, I never have any problems with my logcat. So even if my app crashes, I always see the stack trace.
Definitely. I did the same exact thing. It's super useful. Okay, my second tip is to try a new library every month. Now, you don't have to learn something that's crazy, difficult, or anything of that nature, but maybe if you haven't tried Realm, go ahead and give it a shot. Try to implement maybe a little to-do list application with Realm, see how you like working with objects instead of SQL. Maybe you haven't tried RxJava, give it a shot. Sure, RxJava is a humongous learning curve, but you could also just kind of play around with it and see if you can learn a bit, maybe replace some asynchronous tasks and so forth. The goal here is you'll find that you'll expand your horizons by learning new things, and you may end up finding that you like something a lot more than you originally thought you had, or you find that you end up liking it a lot more than you thought you would initially.
Nice. So my next tip is this, and this was mentioned in this time's Google I/O in the Advanced Android Studio Developers session. So you can use Android Studio and basically any IntelliJ IDE to have a command line launcher. And I've found that Android Studio and basically all of IntelliJ, their diff tool works amazingly well. And so I'll add some links to the show notes. You can use this diff tool basically for your Git diffing, which I use anyway. And it's amazing. Once you get used to the diff tool, it's definitely one of the best I've found. You can use it even for basic file differences. So if you have two files that you want to diff, then with this command line launcher, you can just use the same thing. So I found it to be super useful. I'll add a couple of links in the show notes, one to show how you can do it with Git, the diffing, how you can do it with regular files, and also a link to the session.
Surprise question here. Do you know if that works with merging at all? Like when you say Git merge tool, does it do anything for that?
Oh yeah, for sure. Both diff tool and merge tool. So one of the links that I have in the show notes basically shows how you can do that. So you can totally use it for both of them.
Oh, sweet. Okay. I am totally interested in that now.
And this was like one of the few points I found where like usually when you try to link your versioning repository in Android Studio, like usually people say, I'll just like do it on command line. This is one reason I found that it's actually beneficial to do it, because when merge conflicts come up, you can bring it up in IntelliJ or Android Studio. And I found like, especially for the merging, it works amazingly well. You can say, pick this difference, pick that difference, show me the differences between these two files, those two files. It's crazy good.
I'm going to have to try that out because I've been such a hardcore Git command line user for so long. I love the diffing in Android Studio and in all IntelliJ products. So this is definitely interesting to me. Okay, so speaking of Android Studio, my third tip here is learn all of Android Studio's shortcuts. That's it. No, I'm just kidding. but seriously, learn as many of them as you possibly can. And the best way to do that is to install a plugin called Key Promoter. And I've brought this up a few different times, and I think maybe even a awesome tip way back in the day. And what Key Promoter is a plugin that plugs into Android Studio, and to be honest, this thing will literally annoy the living hell out of you. what it does is like if you click on something, you're using the mouse to click around in Android Studio. If you click on it, what Key Promoter will do, it'll pop up this little annoying overlay that sits there for a few seconds. It says, hey, by the way, you can do the same thing with this key combination. Mm-hmm. What happens is every time you start clicking, it will keep popping that up. So it starts getting so annoying that you automatically learn that key combination so you don't have to see that annoying pop-up anymore. The other great thing is if for some reason you keep clicking on something in the IDE that does not have a shortcut associated to it, Key Promoter will ask you, say, hey, I've noticed you've clicked on this X amount of times. Would you like to assign a custom shortcut to this? I do that to various different things, and it's become pure magic. When I go working on someone else's machine, I assume that those shortcuts are already there. They're not, and I'm not productive at all. So lastly, on top of that, go check out Philip Brault's Android Studio Tips. He has posts 1 through 6, tons of great content with little GIF examples, showing you tons of cool stuff and shortcuts inside of Android Studio. As always, we'll put that into the link of the show notes, the link to Philip's blog post, as well as a link to the Key Promoter plugin.
That's amazing. You know, I actually always felt like a little snob. I was like, oh, I got my keyboard shortcuts down. Like, you know, I don't need Key Promoter. Yeah. But out of a whim, I just installed it maybe like last month. Mm-hmm. And boy, there are some things I didn't even realize I was using my mouse so many times for. And it like really annoyed the hell out of me that I actually learned the shortcut. So anyone stands to benefit from this plugin. So that's a great tip. Okay, so my next tip is actually Android specific. So you know how when you have a view, generally when you want to set the visibility, you have like view.visible, view.invisible, view.gone. Mm-hmm. Almost always you generally don't want view.invisible. It's either gone or visible, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to thank one of my colleagues, Maxim, at Instacart. And we have like this shared sort of library that we use across all our Android applications. And he had this helper, which basically is like, it's a helper class that just says set visibility, and it takes the view and a Boolean. So it just takes true or false. Mm-hmm. And it's such a small thing, but I found myself getting so used to it that actually what we do is like set visibility off, Boolean true or false, and the view. And almost always that's how you think, right? Like, oh, is this view visible or not? Yes or no? Booleans, right? We don't necessarily think with view.visible, view.invisible, view.gone. And the off chance that you do want it to be invisible, you can use that, or you can actually have another one. He has another one that we call set visibility weak. So that's sort of like the invisible variant. I found this to be super useful, so you guys should check that out.
I can't agree with you more. We did this same thing at MyFitnessPal. We created a bunch of helper methods for this, almost the exact same thing you said, but we pass in a Boolean with the views, and we just, you know, turn them on and off. It was so useful. It's one of those things that you get used to having in your code base that when you start a new project, if it's not there, you have to go find it immediately.
Totally, totally. That's exactly how I felt when I worked on a side project recently.
Cool. Okay, so my next tip is to use a window management tool. So this isn't suited just for Android, but for anything that you do on the computer. And mainly, if you're a developer, you're going to have all kinds of windows open anyway. Terminals, Android Studio, Finder windows, you name it, it's probably open. So this will save you massive amounts of time, especially when you have all these different windows open because you're copying files, comparing two different versions of different, you know, applications or multiple Finder windows. Personally, I use a product called Divi, and that's D-I-V-V-Y. You have to pay a few bucks for it. It's great. The nice thing about Divi and other window management tools is you can actually define little regions of your screen, and you can basically turn your screen into like 100 different regions. And you can say, all right, well, these 10 regions, I'm going to call it my top left corner. This half of the screen is my left part of the screen, and this part is the center. You can define these custom regions with shortcut keys. So for example, while we're on this call, I will shrink my browser window to the middle of my screen. By hitting, I think it's Command, Space, Shift, and brings up the little window. I hit C, and I've delegated that to the center of my screen. It basically takes the browser and puts it directly in the middle of the screen, so it's not full screen. And I do the same thing, and I hit F, and it goes full screen. So there's all these different ones that you can create. Definitely check it out. We'll put the link to Divi, as well as a Slant comparison, which is a website, Slant, where they compare various different window management tools. So huge time saver.
Definitely plus one that actually I used to use Divi. I've used another one called Moom, which is like M-O-O-M, but that's Mac specific. Eventually, though, I settled for one called Phoenix. I'll add a link to the specific one.
Okay.
And the reason I like that one is because essentially you can set up your own rules. Like you can, it's a very like developer-y kind of thing. So if you don't want something that requires you to do a lot of configuration, then this is probably not a great suggestion. But the advantage is you can use JavaScript, which is a relatively an easier language to use to sort of like configure all of this. So I've actually settled with that because, like, I have, again, very weird sort of, like, requirements for the window management stuff. Like, I want it to be 1/3 of my screen because I have this huge, massive screen in front of me. So I'm like, I want it to be in 1/3, 2/3, which I guess you can anyway do it with Divi as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'll add a link to that. If you feel like you have too much time in your hands and you want, like, a slightly more complicated tool.
Isn't Phoenix open source too?
Oh yeah, it's open source too. Exactly, yeah.
So that's a huge win too. So if you're looking for that way to break the ice into the window management tools, then this might be your ideal solution here.
My next tip is a more generic one, and I found I've been doing this a lot recently. So I watched this video tutorial site called caster.io by this dude I know, I happen to know pretty well. What I found is when I learn, especially when it's an instructional or like a developer related video, I have this incessant need to sort of like go back and start taking notes on like the things that I've learned so I can go back and remember them.
Yep.
But I found a technique that actually works better is watch every video at least twice. The first time, just watch it like a regular, like if you're drinking coffee or tea or like, you know, having a sandwich in front of you, just watch the video from beginning to end and just try to understand the different concepts like they're saying without worrying too much about taking down notes. Once you do that, the second time around, though, go back and start like jotting down the notes, and then it'll just start making more sense because you already know what's coming, but you can pause the video to sort of like jot down notes and understand what the key highlights are when someone's explaining something. So I've done this so many times with a whole bunch of the caster.io videos that I watch. Like, I'll go back and then make notes so that whenever I have to go back or if I have to share these notes with someone who's learning Android development, then I found it to be super useful.
I do the same thing on various other video platforms as well, especially when I was not able to make the Android Dev Summit. I was able to watch all these on YouTube.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Did the same thing. Binged watch a couple of them. I had a notepad with just regular physical paper. And when I saw something that was interesting, I would just notate the time that it was interesting, then go back later on and kind of dive in deep. Okay, my next tip here is actually a pretty cool one that's fairly useful and also kind of annoying at the same time. This is to add lint failure conditions to your build server. So if your app encounters any lint issues, fail the build. I know that's a little extreme and probably going to be a little heated. Debate between people, but what I have found is that it exposed a lot of areas of my code that I didn't have any clue that were lint failures at all, or lint verification issues. Now it was annoying at first because I would commit some code and it's like, we have 8 lint failures. I'm like, what are you talking about? My code's perfect. there was a lot of stuff in there that I didn't realize that I was using. You need to provide the locale and doing 2 uppercase and 2 lowercase and all different kinds of weird stuff. You can, if for some reason it doesn't matter, you can also just, suppress the warning with the help of Android Studio by hitting Alt Enter. But it's a humongous help because it actually exposes you to various different parts of your code. And as I like to say, anything that's considered a warning could possibly be a failure in the future. So you might as well take a look at it now.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. My next tip is actually super short, and this is keep the source code handy for Android.
Mm-hmm.
Always in Android Studio. It's super simple. These days, I don't even think you need to attach the source code because like the decompile classes sort of already like indicate what the code would look like. So that's pretty handy. But even then, and I can add like a link to the way we do this, but I believe it's through the SDK manager. I've just done this always, so I don't even remember how it's done specifically. Mm-hmm. But I think in the SDK manager, when you have like new SDKs that you want to download down for new versions of the Android operating system, also make sure you have that checkbox for source docs. Because when you want to dive in and actually see what a text view is doing, I remember Don once mentioned like, oh, text view has like thousands of lines of code, right? And I was like, oh, wait, is that true? And then I actually looked in the text view and I was like, holy cow, that's totally true. Because there are so many lines of code. And the way I could do that is by having the source code attached. So if you don't have this, this is the first thing you should go back and do. Figure out, it's super easy. Android Studio makes it really easy these days. Definitely always try to make sure you have the source code handy.
So useful. I remember back in the day when you couldn't have that, you had to go online and download the source and navigate it by hand.
Oh,
this is such a different world. So nice.
Yeah.
That text view has close to 10,000 lines of code in it.
10,000 lines.
Close to 10,000. Last time I looked, it was upwards 9,000 something. Anyway, All right, so my next tip here is very similar to the previous one, which is implement check style rules. If you're not familiar with check style is, it helps you maintain proper coding standards across the team. Now, variances in your coding standards across the team can easily give you gray hairs. I don't know how many times you've probably heard the conversation of, well, should I use tabs or spaces? I mean, that's a humongous evergreen debate as usual. But there's all different types of things as well that can, you know, slowly drive you mad. Implementing check style rules will help you alleviate some of that madness. Now, again, it can be kind of a pain and it is kind of annoying at first if you implement it to fail the build. And if you already have an existing project that's been around, failing your build on lint or check style is just going to be a real pain in the butt. But there's ways that you can implement them over the long term and slowly up the percentage of things that are fixed. But anyway, if you want to make sure that your coding standards are the same across the board, implement some check style rules in your builds.
My next tip is actually a very simple one. Whenever you have trouble with your external libraries, because I know many people still, and this has changed with most recent versions of Android Studio, they've gotten really good about this, but I remember almost like three or four months back, whenever you add a new external library, Android Studio would think that it's added in, but then when you actually see the definitions, everything will fail because then the dependency wouldn't have been pulled in. And then you're worrying, wait, does this even exist? Am I using the API correctly? Did the library get imported properly? It was kind of painful before, but there are two tips that I usually use to make sure that I know what I'm doing. The quick way to check if it actually got imported or not is in your project view on the side. If you go all the way to the bottom, you have this thing called external libraries, and it's like a drop down. Like, have that go down, and then you'll see all of the different sort of versions of the libraries, external libraries that you're using. At least the jars would be there. So that's like an indication if it's actually imported or not. If it's not imported, hit whatever your shortcut is for sort of like resyncing your Android Studio. So this is like the Gradle sync. I'm not sure what the standard one. For me, it's Command-Alt-S, but I'm pretty sure that's different from what most people have it default configured with. But if you do the Gradle and sync, usually that clears up all errors. And they've gotten really good with this, like with the latest versions of beta. Like if you hit that, like almost always, like, you know, it's a 10 on 10 sort of hit rate. So you always get perfect library pulling of dependencies. So
yeah, having that, the build Gradle sync set to a shortcut key that's easy for you to remember is key. That's one of the ones that I set as soon as I install Android Studio.
Smart man.
Now, speaking of third-party libraries, bringing them in can be fun because it can help you out a lot. Kind of relates to my next tip here, and that's occasionally evaluate all of your third-party libraries. And this could be, you know, maybe once a month or maybe even once a quarter. It doesn't have to be like every time you open your project. And the reason why I say that is because I have been the guilty party here where I have pulled in a library because I needed a special feature and it helped me. And then come to find out that that library is, I'm not even using 98% of it because I'm using this one utility function that just saved me some time. In that case, what you can do a lot of the times, if you're just adhering to the license and keeping the license intact, is go ahead and take that, you know, utility function, whatever you need, and just pull it into your applications. Keep the same package format, but then you can kind of lose that dependency and lose the other 98% of the stuff that you don't need. Now, again, this all depends on the license of the open source project or third-party library that you're using, so make sure you adhere to that. But this can help clean up your build.gradle file, your dependencies, and reduce a little bit of bloat in your application.
I found myself guilty of that problem too. Like, you have libraries and then, okay, and as the app grows, like, you realize that actually I don't even need these anymore. So
exactly.
My next step is sort of like in the productivity. So I'm entering the productivity genre or section for my tips. Basically, I found a good yardstick to know when to automate something, because I usually like having these automated scripts and things automatically be done for me. But sometimes there's always like trying to evaluate the trade-off. Like, should I actually spend time building the script to do this? Or should I just like do it once or twice and then, like, you know, not have to worry about it? Because if it actually takes more time to write the script and you're only going to execute it like a few times, that doesn't make any sense. So a good yardstick that I've found is, in a day, if I find myself doing something more than three times, automate it. So that's basically the yardstick. And this has like worked weirdly well for me. So even if it takes like 30 times the amount for like you to actually write the script, do it. Because if you do it more than 3 times a day, then almost always there's a guarantee that automating it will save you a whole bunch of time. So that's like yardstick one for me to sort of get on my productivity gain cycles.
You're onto something here too. And there's a, you know, even to segue, I mean, to add on to this a little bit, this can kind of go for any productivity hack that you have. For example, on all of my Git stuff and my and various different shell scripts, I'll alias a lot of things to just like one character.
Oh, yeah.
And so it may not seem like a lot. And I did this back in Windows, like way back in the mid-2000s. I would always open Notepad in Windows. And so then what I did is I just created a batch file and called it N. And so when I would hit the Windows R button, which would open the run command, I'd type N, hit enter. Now, it saved me, you know, all those Notepad characters, but I must have opened Notepad probably 30 times a day. And if you start calculating that up over the week, like you just save maybe an hour of time of opening, or maybe a month, you know, an hour of your month, you know, typing Notepad over and over and over. So small little wins, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. That makes sense. Another one I have alias, speaking of alias, is like Git, Rebase, Origin, yes. Master. Like when you do all these things, I found myself having aliases. But what, and I think I mentioned this in our last Tips and Tricks episode, but what I do is the alias that I have, I keep it as the beginning alphabet or the beginning alphabet of all the commands. So that way I don't actually forget the commands, because invariably when I'm on someone else's machine and I'm trying to remember the command, I just keep typing GRM, GCE, GCM, GCAM, and nothing happens. So I found that having those beginning characters, it helps me remember what the actual Git command is as well. So great tip there, yeah.
Yep, I do the same exact thing. Okay, my next tip is actually related to Gradle. Now, Gradle and Groovy do have a bad rap for a lot of reasons. It's just difficult to learn. It looks like JSON. Some people think it is JSON. but then doesn't look like JSON sometimes. Sometimes it looks like a method. So it's really hard to understand what's going on unless you kind of dive into the details. And so what I recommend all folks do is just write a couple of simple Gradle tasks inside of your build script. And here's a perfect example. You could write one task that copies your third-party dependencies out into another folder in your build directory, and that's known as a copy task. And then you could zip them up using a zip task. That's so you'd have two tasks now. And then you could take one that just runs a command line thing that maybe counts the number of, you know, runs the ls command to count the number of files in a directory. This, and then you could also implement them so they depend on each other. And so there's all different types of things you end up learning in this process, and how to test them through the command line and all the different errors you'll run into. Really helpful to help understand how part of the Gradle process works. If you would like to learn a little bit more, Anise Davis does have a couple of Gradle videos on Castor.io. We'll add those to the show notes as well. But all these are not needed to watch the video. It's just additional learning material if you'd like. But you can use a copy task, zip task, use something, and write something for your Gradle project just to get a little more familiar with it.
Yeah, I recommend Denise's Gradle videos as well. She has a very nice knack of clean explaining things, so highly recommended. My next tip is this thing that I've made for myself called the Twitter threshold test. I don't know if this is something that exists, if someone else has thought about it, they probably have. Whenever I'm trying to find out if like my tests take a long time or if like my builds need to be faster, this is like an evaluation technique that I use for myself. Whenever I'm doing a task, and if I'm waiting just long enough for me to go onto Twitter and then check what's happening, I know something's failing in my process. So I use this as like a general yardstick. And I use it for everything. Like if I'm actually cooking something or if I'm like waiting for someone in line and I notice that I'm just hanging around there and I slowly get my phone up and I start to browse Twitter, then automatically now like a signal goes in my head thinking, oh, If this is clearly an inefficient process, so something needs to be done here so I don't have to like, I don't default to going to Twitter. So I call it the Twitter threshold test.
That's a great tip. You could also replace Twitter with Reddit, Facebook, many of those social networks that you're completely addicted to.
Absolutely. Snapchat, that's what the kids use these days.
What's up, Snaps?
Yeah, Snaps. There we go.
As you could tell, I'm watching too much Justin Kahn on Snapchat. My next tip here is actually one that I'm fairly passionate about, and that is I feel that we need to have Postman scripts for all REST API endpoints. If you're not familiar with Postman, Postman is a Chrome extension. It's free. You can also purchase the upgrade, which I feel is completely worth it. Every single penny. I have had the upgrade for a couple of years now, and if they were even a monthly fee, I'd even pay it. It's that useful. Now, Postman is so nice because you can create these scripts and you can save them and you can export them. You can also create these environments and, hey, it's going to connect to the staging environment or connect to this production environment. So you can create these different things. The great thing is you can export them, put them inside of your application in like a little Postman folder. Now, it's really useful because you can actually hit the API with nothing in between it. So it's like executing a curl request, except you have this nice GUI to work with. And being able to see that raw request will be able to help you build your application faster, because now you can see, all right, here's all the parameters that I need in the body or the query or et cetera. And here's what the response looks like. That's JSON. And you can actually interact with it just right there in your hands. And you're not down in the guts writing curl commands. The other great thing is it can actually generate curl commands or other different types of HTTP commands that you can send to other folks as well. Now, the real cool thing is here, if you can get your server folks to develop these for you by the time your API gets to you, you are winning the battle here, because you'll have examples basically given to you. Inside of Postman, you can also write tests. So these tests, you can actually, it's just JavaScript. You can actually say, hey, I got a 200 back from the server and it contained this data that I expected to come back, and the size of this array was greater than 1 or it was equal to 12 or whatever. Very useful. You can run those tests. It can be a humongous, safety check for if for some reason you think the API is down because your app's not working. You can fire up your Postman scripts, run your tests, and if any of them fail, you now have proof that something is not working as you expect it to. To further that, if you really want to be proactive, you can then take those Postman scripts and import them into a tool like Runscope, and that's runscope.com. And with Runscope, you have create automated and recurring API tests to ensure that an API is always up. So if an API goes down for whatever reason, Runscope will then let the team know. So it's kind of like a PagerDuty type of thing for your API.
Nice.
Yeah, very useful. I mean, there's always been those instances where you're at work and it's like, well, is the API down? I don't know. I think it's up. And then you look and for some reason, this weird API call is broken for some weird reason because of a recent deployment and that a test missed. But it's kind of like integration tests for your API. Now, again, what I would recommend you do is if you don't have them, create them for yourself and then create a folder in your Android application and just call it Postman scripts or just Postman. Mm-hmm. Put all of the scripts and the environment in there. You can export them from Postman and commit them to your Git repository. All of your other teammates can then use them as well, and you guys can build this nice library of requests. It will save you and your teammates a ton of time when arguing with the server folks, unless you are also the server team.
In which case, ooh. Yeah, ooh. All right, that's a great tip. In fact, one of my colleagues at Instacart, she's an amazing backend developer, and what I used to do is, like, when I had these curl commands, like, very meticulously maintained, mm-hmm. like, notes, like, in my Evernote folder or my Dropbox paper folder, I used to have, I have this document called curl commands. And mm-hmm. I used to basically just add all those curl commands. And so the next time I had to test something, I'd go look for the curl command that I was using, and then I would use that. And then when I went over and, like, we were trying to jointly debug an issue, she told me, what kind of like animal behavior is this? Like, you shouldn't be using curl commands like this Postman. Why don't you just use Postman? And I was like, what the hell is Postman? And then I found out and life changed. So definitely great tip there.
The one just as another tip to that, if you do, and a lot of people do have a ton of curl commands out there, if you have those curl commands, you can actually take those in Postman and use the import functionality in Postman. Paste in your curl request and it will build out the Postman request for you.
Oh, interesting.
So then you can migrate yourself off of curl.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I will keep an eye for that and try to use that now for all the leftover curl commands that I still have in that note.
We'll try to wean you off of them.
Yeah. All right. So this one is a generic good practice for writing good software. Whenever you write code, optimize for deletion. I found once I keep that as my sort of like general rule, I found that actually my code becomes much better. And it's kind of like counterintuitive. But The idea is when you write code, write it in a way that it makes it super easy for you to actually delete it later on. So you write a swath of code and always keep thinking to yourself, okay, 2 months from now, I might just come and delete all of this code. And I found that it sort of like brings a very liberating kind of feeling where you intentionally modularize stuff, and it indirectly sort of encourages very good practices for code. So I found myself sticking to this where I try to optimize for deletion. Anything that I write, especially when you're working with bigger teams, it's always nice to write the swath of code so that you know fully well that, okay, this is something that might go on later. So you don't hold too much to it. Mm-hmm. I found when people use this, they don't necessarily think, oh, what if I have to use like something else? Like, you know, the whole Yagni thing that you yes. mentioned in your episode, like yeah. I found people like tame down those urges and they don't find themselves adding a new library helper just for the sake of doing something. Because, well, if I'm going to delete it, I'm not going to spend any more time on it, right? So I found this to be super useful. Usually the two biggest things that I've found that have really improved in general my skills as a software engineer is write code that optimizes for deletion, and also code readability. Mm-hmm. Everything else is secondary to me, like performance, anything that you can think of, like it's almost secondary. The two things that I always keep track of are these two. And I found that if you stick to this, eventually the code that you write just becomes much more nicer.
It is. And I think that one of the reasons I like this tip so much is because of you've putting yourself in the mindset of that this code may be deleted one day. And I think I brought this up in one of my recent talks, is that that removes this emotional attachment from this code. We should care about what we're doing as craftsmen and developers, that we do craft good, elegant solutions. But we also need to realize that what we're building here may end up being deleted tomorrow or a week or a year from now.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And if we can remove that emotional attachment to it, we realize that we're just moving forward and iterating, and we're not going to have a humongous emotional burden when something like this that you've created and put all of your heart and soul into gets kind of just deleted.
Very true. Very true.
Okay, my next tip is kind of one that a lot of folks brought up on our Google I/O episodes, and that's actually running two versions of Android Studio. I recommend that you run the latest stable version. This is going to be your default go-to, so you can stay productive for your company or your clients or whatever. And then I also recommend that you run the latest Canary or beta. Now, if you want to run the Canary, that's up to you, or beta. I will give it to the Android Tools team. They have done a killer job at making sure that the Canaries are very, very stable. Back when Android Studio first came out, the Canary died a lot, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I was very leery of actually running the Canary. But now it's very stable. A few crashes here and there, but it's expected in an early release product like that. So to do that, you're just going to install your regular stable version, which you normally keep, and then you're going to download the other Android Studio. Just download the file, and then you're going to want to change the name of that. Just, you know, rename the file, and this is in a Mac, to Android Studio 2.x or 2.3, whatever version you're working with. And then you can install it in your applications folder, and you can actually have them both running side by side. So if you want to try out the new constraint layout and not affect your current environment, that's great. Now, the only downfall here is that if you're on a team, there are certain instances when these upgrades will require you to upgrade the Gradle plugin. That can be a real bummer, but my next tip will help talk about how you can solve that. So just be aware of that.
Ooh, interesting. Okay, I'm waiting for your next tip. But in the meantime, so my next tip is again Android related, and this is the Recycler View. I found that as more and more people have adopted Recycler View, people still get a little lazy when they, on the adapter, they call notified dataset changed. Now, the problem with this, and Eat, who's a friend of the show and also basically one of the folks from Google who worked on Recycler View, he mentioned a couple of videos. I don't recall exactly which one, but I'm sure, like, if you see any of his talks, he mentions this. Don't call notify dataset changed on the adapter, because people, it's easy. Like in our previous episode, we talked to Huen, and then, you know, you call invalidate and you sort of get into the habit of like, just like call invalidate, boom. And yeah, you have like a reset state. Don't do that on your recycler views, because this is actually costly. Notify dataset changed means you're telling the recycler view, hey, in the 10 views that you have listed, one of them is changed. I don't know which one. So it's actually going to go through all the 10 sort of views, and it's going to try to issue a change. So that can be really costly in terms of performance. There's a much better variant. You can notify a specific item. So I think it's actually just called that, notify item added, notify item removed, and you can pass in the position. And if you can do that, you almost always, you should be in a position to be able to specify which element has changed. If you do that, then that just makes it much more nicer. And it also, I think, additionally gives you the default animations that are built in with the recycler view. So I highly recommend that you use those specific variants of the notify method versus just going all nuclear on your recycler views and saying notify data set changed on everything.
Definitely. I could see how that would be quite detrimental, especially if your view hierarchy is quite complex. It could, all that overdraw could probably kind of kill you, I imagine. Okay, so let's go back here. And remember I said that when you upgrade your, if you have two versions of Android Studio running, you may run into the issue where you have your build.gradle file and you need to change the, you know, perhaps you need to change the Gradle plugin because you're using a new version of Android Studio. That's very common. However, if you're on a team and you don't want to commit that file because now you'd affect all of your teammates and you don't want everyone to update, there is a way you can actually tell Git to ignore that. Now, Git has a cool little command here. It's called update index, and that's update hyphen index, and you can pass it another switch called assume unchanged. So it's not too intuitive, but basically what this does is you can tell Git to ignore a file. And what that basically says is, hey, Git, I know this is inside of your repository, but I'm going to go ahead and make some changes to it, but I want you to pretend that I didn't change anything. And so it basically says, hey, just assume that this is unchanged. And while that is running, if you tell Git, give me the status, it will say, hey, I don't see you didn't change your build.gradle file, but maybe you did actually. So it'll ignore that change whatsoever. Now, this is kind of a very verbose command to type, and I never remember the syntax. So I have aliased this, and I have created a gist on GitHub, which we will put in the show notes. And I just call it unwatch and watch. And those are the two aliases I use. And I say, so I'll say git unwatch and then the path to the file. And then git kind of just ignores any changes to that file until I tell it to start watching it again. Now, this is important that you realize that you have stopped watching that file, because if you end to add a dependency and you forget to commit that in, your build server is going to crash. Say, hey, I don't know about this third party, you know, dependency you just added. So you will need to make sure that you start watching that file again. But we'll put the link in the show notes for that so you can start watching and unwatching files.
I like that alias watch and unwatch. It makes a lot of sense. It's a pretty good alias.
Thank you.
I'm going to steal that one. All right. So for my next tip, customization is cool, and people generally tend to customize a lot, especially with developers. There's a tendency to over-customize. So my tip is actually don't go crazy with the whole customization. Now, I learned this the hard way, and the example that I'm going to give is usually when I install the Android SDKs previously, I got to this point where like, oh, I want everything to be command line driven. So if I can just like run a script, go, catch the latest episode of Game of Thrones or something, and then come back, everything is like set up and ready to go. Mm-hmm. To this effect, what I used to do is I used to use Brew to install the Android SDK. You can do this. But what I found out is like it actually, Brew has a sort of like specific constraint. It installs it in the user local bin or seller.bin or location.
Yeah.
The problem is recently, when I was using Android Studio, when I was trying to change something specifically, I think it was when I was trying to try the new Jack tool chain. Mm-hmm. And so I had to keep bouncing between like different versions. I noticed that it was such a big pain because I was using like a non-standard directory. And after some time when I thought about it, I realized there's really no reason I should be doing this. So I actually stopped installing the Android SDK using Brew, and I just use Android Studio's default mechanism, and I think it puts it by default in the library Android SDK folder. Mm-hmm. And this works perfectly well now, because like anytime I uninstall, I install, it's all in the library, it's all good. And I found that sometimes going with the default helps a huge bunch. So don't try to go crazy with your customization.
Yeah, I had the same exact problem. I used to put mine in like root OPT Android SDK. And so same thing. Yeah. But I agree. I just use the default now. Works great. Okay. Now we kind of touched on my next tip a little bit prior. So Kaushik, you stole my thunder on this one, but it's all right. I'll forgive you this time. And this one is to create shortcuts for all of your Git commands. And so I talked about how I aliased watch and unwatch. Now I have almost all of my entire Git commands aliased. I recently did a screen share with a client in Arizona, and I was helping them actually check this out. I was upgrading a project from Eclipse to Android Studio. That's how long this project had not been touched.
God. Holy cow!
And so they had their end. They had just hired a new dev, and they wanted them to watch what I was doing. And then I just kind of pulled up the command line and started typing commands. It's like, whoa, what are you, what's GPOM, what's, you know, G space POD and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, and so what that is I, like I said, I alias the Git command to just the letter G. So anything that's, I type G now, that means Git. And then I have a Git config, which we'll put in the show notes, that aliases, I mean, just a whole ton of stuff that's like, if I want to say rebase continue, it'd be G space RBC. If I want to do git push origin master, I say G space POM. So it's GPOM. Then if I want to push to git origin push develop, it's G space POD. And there's just a ton of these that I have in here. B is for branch and all different kinds of stuff. So just it takes a little bit to learn, but once you learn it, your keystrokes are just much shorter and much less verbose. So definitely worth taking the time to learn. And I'll share that in the show notes.
Very cool. In fact, you know, I was looking at the show notes and I just noticed that you had these commands and all of these make perfect sense. GRBC, GPOM, like I have the almost exact same command. So
that's fun.
Yeah, so I think that is a fantastic tip. And I'll share my Git config as well so people can pick and choose the ones they like.
That'd be cool.
Cool. So my next tip is on RxJava. I haven't talked about RxJava in a long time, so I'm actually proud of myself because there was this time where like almost every single episode we used to somehow bring it up. But I think it's fair. It's been some time, so I'm going to bring up my next two tips are going to be on RxJava. The first tip I have is you should create a small helper class. And I have this. It's called LogExOnlySubscriber. Now, what I found is many a time when people use RxJava, eventually when they create the subscription, they call .subscribe, open parentheses, close parentheses, and then they're on with their way. And this technically works perfectly well until somewhere in the chain you have an exception. Then it like blows in your face saying on error, not implemented.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, oh man, like, well, what exactly went wrong? I don't know. Because like, if you have a long tool chain, then it's hard to detect where something went wrong. What I've found is these days, almost always, when you create a subscriber, you want to log the exception inside on error. So your on error body almost always has some information. And you want the on completed, typically. The on next, almost, I've at least like this is in practice, I found that with the subscriber on next, I generally don't use it because I've already used that object at some point in a previous in the call chain, right? At some point, I've already used that object. So I found myself not using on next that much. So what I used to do is in the subscribe, I used to call new action one or whatever the thing is. And so there you can specify just the immediate callback. So you can specify just on you can specify just on completed and then on error, right? And so then you don't have to specify that extra method which calls on next. But then I found this also becomes too verbose because every time I just have a simple subscribe where all I really want is the on error, it becomes kind of a pain. So what I did is I built like the small helper class and it's like super straightforward. I can add a gist for it. And by default, what it does is it has an empty on completed. It has an empty on next. But in the on error, basically, I log the exception that's being called. And it's so easy for me. So anytime I have like dot subscribe, I just plop in a new log ex only subscriber. And boom, that usually works pretty well.
I would love to see what you're doing with the on next and all that stuff in a blog post sometime.
Oh, sure. I will add that to list. Definitely will do something.
I'm sure a lot of people were, you piqued their interest. Were like, what, you're not using on next? What are you using?
That is good content for a blog post, I imagine.
Definitely. All right, my next tip here, the last few that I have are a little more higher level. But number 13 that I have for me is be pragmatic. And so a lot of questions that come up are, should you use Model View Presenter? Should you use MVVM or custom views or anything like that? I think the better question is you know, what's your current problem and what solves the problem right now? If it's custom views or model view, view model or MVP that solve your current problem, then go for it. But if not, then you might want to rethink your solution, and you might just want to keep it a little more simple until you know a little bit more about what you're doing. Just be a little bit more pragmatic in your day-to-day development.
Yeah, that being pragmatic, I like that motto. All right, so my next one is again an RxJava tip. And this one I'll add a link to the show notes to the gist. And this is basically like a hack for usually getting your, for example, I found with integration testing in RxJava, typically people always have problems with trying to implement the custom idling handler so that Espresso understands that all of this happens in the same thread. So I'll basically add a link. And I think people have also posted this, but the best way and easiest way to get going with RxJava and make sure everyone's on the same idling resource is basically piggyback off the async tasks scheduler, because that's already built in. The folks at Espresso, that's why if you notice, if you have an async task, it actually waits for that. Espresso tests wait for the async tasks, right? So what I do is all my RxJava, using the Rx scheduler hooks, all I do is I just say, hey, actually just go and point to the async task scheduler. So I kind of like mimic that. And I found that it's super safe for you. You don't have to do any customization. And this almost works like 95% of the time. So I'll add a link to that in the show notes. And it's super useful because you don't have to go through the actual implementation of like an idling resource handler.
That's very useful. I've been wondering how a lot of people do that and how you do it. So cool thing. My next tip here is to become a good citizen on video calls by muting yourself on the video conference. Nothing's more annoying when you hear your coworkers in the background noise from their conference call when they don't have their mic muted and you're trying to listen to what the speaker is saying. If your tool that you're using for your video conferences allows for auto muting, please do that. Tools like Zoom.us and a few others do that. However, if you're not using a tool that allows you to auto mute upon joining a call, then go ahead and you might want to check out a tool called Shush. And this is a hat tip to the engineering team at American Express, which they pointed me to this tool that I use now. And it automatically keeps your microphone muted unless you hold like the function key or whatever key you define it to be. And so it's basically like a push to talk type of scenario. So the mic will not be activated unless you push to talk. However, there is a caveat here. If you're like Kaushik and I and you are super audiophile nerds and you have like external audio interfaces, it won't work. If you're using a regular like USB mic or your headphone mic or anything like that, then it will work just fine. But if it's an external audio interface, it won't work. So for 95, 99% of the people out there, it'll work perfectly. For folks like me and Kaushik, we'll have to resort to using dials and knobs.
Yeah, good point. I was going to say that for the 5% of us, we probably have to go old school and get like physical sort of like switches for muting.
True. Yes, true.
All right. So my last tip is leverage 3 of these IntelliJ plugins. And these are really cool. You already pointed to Key Promoter. I've got another 3. One is string manipulation. Look at it. It's amazing. This plugin basically allows you to keep toggling between camel case, between snake case, lowercase, uppercase, capitalize, especially if you're in Android Studio all day long. I think this just works amazingly well. So string manipulation is the name of that plugin. I'll add a link again to that to the show notes. I found this to be super useful. The next plugin is line sorter. So I found whenever you want to sort lines, it's kind of like a simple thing, but it's also something that's not actually built in. So if you want to sort like your variables alphabetically, because like, you know, if you have problems like me and if it's in non-alphabetic order and that like makes you lose sleep at night, then this plugin is super useful because it allows you to sort in different fashion. So that's the next plugin, also super cool. The next one is actually built in. So it isn't necessarily a third-party plugin. If you link your GitHub repository through Android Studio, you can click any line, right-click and say open in GitHub. And why this is super useful is because if you actually have that branch and that line of code in GitHub, if you work in a team and you want to like quickly say, hey, this is the line that I'm talking about without having to paste the snippet, you can just right-click, say open in GitHub, get that link and shoot it off in Slack or whatever your IM tool is to your colleagues. And they know exactly the line of code that you're talking about. Hat tip to my colleague, Erwin, for this one at Instacart. But I found like once I started using this, it's super easy. So you can keep talking about code really easily.
That's super useful. I never thought of that use case. I could see what would be insanely useful.
Yeah. Great IntelliJ plugins.
All right, so we'll handle my last tip here, and this one is very meta and kind of applies to everybody here, and that's actually just take care of your body. Now, there's a bunch of different things that that could go wrong here. The first thing that I'm going to say that is, if your back hurts, I highly recommend you go get the book called 8 Steps to a Pain-Free Back. This is a great book. Just grab the physical copy. You have to get the physical copy. Tons of pictures, diagrams, and et cetera. This also goes down to, they explain how you should be sitting, how you should even be sleeping, how you should, different types of walking, standing. And you'll find all different areas of your body that you're using incorrectly and that you can actually fix. And so get the physical copy, put it on your desk. You need to be able to hold it and see it. It's a great reference. The next one is, if you can afford it, get a stand-up desk. There's a couple of that I've tried. I've tried the IKEA Bacant, and I will provide links again for all of these. And that's the IKEA stand-up desk. Works great. It's very sturdy. I have one right now that we're recording on. And I also have tried the Autonomous Smart Desk as well. That one's a little bit smaller than the IKEA one. A very nice build. Very cheap. I think it starts like at $299. Very useful. Ask your company if they can buy it for you. Standing half of the day at least is phenomenal. It helps relieve a bunch of back pain as well. Long story short, you only get one body, so take care of it. You know, you're going to spend $2,000 or more on a computer, but not $300 a desk. You might want to think about that a little bit, you know? and then the secret weapon that I have here that I've also, I think Kaushik shares as well, is, you know, you need to get sleep. I at least get 7 hours of sleep a night. This is actually my secret weapon, is what I say. People say, how do you get so much done? I said, I get 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. It just leaves me fresh and recharged. If I get less than 6, I'm kind of groggy. If I get into the 5 or less range, then I'm pretty much absolutely worthless the next day. So definitely respect the sleep.
Word. I know we have talked about this offline, and this is something that I truly believe. Like, do not compromise on sleep. I used to have this bad habit where I could go with basically 4 hours of sleep. And so I used to do that for like almost like 5 years of my life. Like almost all weekdays, I used to get like just 4 hours of sleep. Oh. And I was like, no, I'm getting work done. And then the weekends, I'll probably try to catch up on lost sleep. But I was basically torturing my body. And I thought I was like doing good, but it's crazy. And last year, my New Year resolution was basically to get 7 hours of sleep no matter what. And I've been sticking to it. And so these days, that's basically what I do. I have like no compromise. If I sleep late, well, in that case, I'm going to get 7. I'm going to bear the consequences for going late to whatever my appointment is the next day. 7 hours of sleep, always.
Yes, I cannot recommend more. I feel so much better getting a good night's sleep. It's going to be a late night for me tonight, but tomorrow I'll sleep in a little bit later. Got to get it done.
All right. I think that sounds like the perfect plan. Awesome. So I hope folks enjoyed the show. These tend to be super power-packed ones, but I think like we have like some juicy tips. And usually to keep it interesting, like we don't necessarily look at each other's tips. And so that's why when Don mentions his tips, I'm also very keenly listening. And that tends to take the show. But I'm sure like a whole bunch of you would find that useful. If you have tips that you would like to send us, then, you know, FragmentedCast is our Twitter handle, and shoot it out so we can share your tips with other listeners. And if folks want to reach out to you, Don, how do they do that?
They can reach out on Twitter at Don Felker, or you can send me a long-winded email at donfelker.com.
Perfect. And I am Kaushik Gopal on Twitter. And unfortunately, there exists no way to send me a long email. So sorry about that.
Email him. I have his email address.
You can find the show notes for this episode at fragmentedpodcast.com/episodes/48. Once again, we want to thank Hired for sponsoring this show. Finding a job should be fast, focused, and stress-free. And Hired.com helps with just that. Use the special link hired.com/fragmented for double the signing bonus. Thank you all for listening, and we will catch you next week.
See you guys later.